We did begin upon Jacob's great trial last week as he went forth from the place of his long exile with his numerous family and with his flocks and his herds and no doubt quite an army of manservants and women servants about whom we know very little and hear very little, but they must have numbered quite a considerable force as he moved slowly and deliberately along that wilderness journey between the place of his exile down in the south of the river Euphrates back to his home and kindred. Where Esau, his brother, was waiting for him with an army of 400 men to destroy. And we saw last week something of Jacob's prayer at Mahanaim and his preparations for the inevitable encounter with his fierce brother and his ungovernable rage. 20 years of absence have not cooled. Now we reach that point where we have read of Jacob having sent on across the ford Jabbok, which is a sort of a boundary of the territory from which he was coming to that to which he was going. A sort of Rubicon which Julius Caesar crossed in the north of Italy on his way back to Rome, which no man was allowed to cross without permission of the Senate. And he, without that permission, crossed, which is tantamount to an act of war against the authorities in Rome. So Jacob, he crosses the ford Jabbok and is committed irrevocably to the encounter with his brother Esau, not knowing what the outcome might be, only knowing of his own extreme weakness and his incapability of meeting any force whatever that could come against him. Only had with him shepherds and herdsmen, flocks and herds, mothers and children. And he, the one man in the whole scene, who was responsible for them all and for their welfare. Heavy responsibility indeed, which fell upon the shoulders of this dear man. Had he not been a man of faith, he could not have survived the ordeal. The greatest man in this world is the man of faith, the man who believes. There is none so great as he. Others may be great captains, great statesmen, great in their accomplishments in this field or another field, handing down their names or their works or their art or their record to posterity, having a large illuminated name upon the page of history, but nevertheless very small in the different judgment of heaven. Where that only is great which leans upon its God, that only is considerable which is considerable in faith, in believing. We are glad that it is this way. Some of us are not richly endowed with talents and gifts, or even with opportunities, such as others may have, and are not destined anyway to to do anything considerable or noteworthy in a public way in this world. Some of us only to bring up a family. Some of us only as heads of our little group to see to their welfare and their provision as best we can. To serve faithfully thus in a common and ordinary way of life. But we are not to count this occupation and this destiny of ours in the world as a small account, or even anything less than the great captain of military history, the great men of state, the great doctors of medicine, the great explorers and missionaries. We're not to count ourselves anything less than these in the sight of God, or our accomplishment in His sight as being less than His, less than theirs. But to all shall be said, however much they may have done, or however little may have been allowed to them, it will be said to them who are faithful, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful in a very little. Have thou ruled over a great destiny." Not so surely, he said, to the great evangelist, the great theologians of history, and the Apostle Paul himself, if he were here, in some respects the greatest of them all, would say in his own deep humility, "I am less than the least of all saints. Nor is this a false modesty which makes me say it, but something within me which makes me feel it, that I can never live down my past, or ever forget my own unworthiness. And if I have labored more abundantly than others, it's not I, but the grace of God that is in me." And Paul would add, if he were here, he would say, "In the name of God, I expect no higher reward when I get there than what is common to all the dear saints of God, when the Lord shall say to them, 'Thou hast been faithful in a very little. Have thou ruled over very much.'" So it is that we read this great story of Jacob, not simply as that which is exclusive to himself, but has all along been designed amongst other of God's complex intentions, designed to comfort you and me and enable us to see that as Jacob was, so are we. And if the consequences in his case seem very much greater than the consequences in our case, it makes no difference. For if God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, He is also your God and mine, and is pleased to be known as our God, and ready to recognize us in that world, just as He recognized Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob of old. And so we come to Jacob, left behind alone on the farther side of the ford Jabbok, between him and his family and his company, and looking beyond them, between him and his brother Esau, coming to meet him with 400 armed men. There is just this rude stream, the ford Jabbok. Some might say, who are very fond of questioning the integrity of God's great men. They might say, well, what was he doing deserting the women and children and the rest of the company during that dangerous night when he ought to have been with them cheering them up? Instead of that, he goes back across the brook and stays there alone. Well, of course, we know differently. He remained there alone because he knew he had an encounter with a greater than Esau. There was due for him there a conflict with God himself. You say, how would Jacob know that? Because he was a prophet. And under a prophetic impulse, which came only from God, he sent his company across the stream and then returned alone to pray and to wrestle with God. He did not know, of course, even prophetically, that there would be a physical side to that conflict. But he knew he had a reckoning with God that night. And so we read that Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. But it was a long encounter he had. In the darkness, he was suddenly assailed by an unknown stranger, unseen because of the blackness of the night. It might have been Esau. It might have been some other foe. But he grappled with him, and the two wrestled with might and main all that night until the breaking of the day. At what stage it was that Jacob realized that it was no man with whom he wrestled, but an angel? And at what time, at what place, he recognized that that angel was the angel of God, in that special prophetic sense, which means the Word of God. Christ, the power and the wisdom of God. The seed of the woman that was to bruise the serpent's head. He upon whom the faith of all creation rested, and the hope of all men depended upon him. At what point of the conflict Jacob realized this? We are not informed, and we cannot speculate. But we do know this, that towards the breaking of the day, when his assailant must depart, for he would not show his face then unto Jacob, when the time came for this great adversary to remove, Jacob clung to him. The man, the God-man, saw that he prevailed not against Jacob, and he touched with his miraculous touch his all-powerful finger which made the world, the hollow of Jacob's thigh, so that the great nerve and sinew shrank, and Jacob could no longer wrestle, but cling with all his might to his assailant. So that the God-man said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And Jacob said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. Now this, dear friends, is the greatest prophetical moment in the history of mankind. This is the greatest thing that ever happened to man as such. Greater than any experience of Abraham, of Isaac or Jacob, of Moses, of Peter, James, and John, of the Apostle Paul, of anyone you can mention. This touched the very highest beyond any experience of man upon earth that we know. Abraham spoke with God as a friend, so he became known as the friend of God. Moses spake face to face with God as a man speaker with his friend. Peter, James, and John saw the glory of the Lord on the Mount of Transfiguration and bowed low in adoration. The Apostle Paul knew more than any man of divine love and redeeming grace to the most undeserving of sinners. But Jacob wrestled with God as a man wrestles with a foe. Jacob was the man who took hold of omnipotence. Within his 10 fingers, and had power with God and prevailed, and brought God to a standstill and a complete surrender to man. Read the account and you see it. Omnipotence could not break away from that man's faith and that man's desire. Let me go, he said. For the day breaketh. It is time that I was gone, and you cling to me still. I will not, said Jacob, I will not, except thou bless me. I want the assurance divine that not only I am safe, but those women and children across the brook, and all that they represent in all subsequent prosperity down to the end of the world, because I am the man who has the birthright and through whom the world's redemption will come and the salvation of the redeemed to the uttermost corners of time. And for this I, in their name and as their representative, I cling to you until I'm assured what I desire is true and is granted. Nothing less than this. And faith took hold with both its hands and said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. And the God-man yields, omnipotence bound, before the faith of one man, and places all its resources at his disposal and on his behalf. In the word, what is thy name? And Jacob said, my name is Jacob. And the God man replied, thy name shall be no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. For the name Israel means a prince with God. Or, to give it its most startling interpretation, the overcomer of God, he who has prevailed against God, fought with him, wrestled with him, and won. That's the name, meaning of the name Israel. And that is why the name Israel is given to this latest day, not to the remnants of a Jewish nation scattered throughout the world. That's not Israel. But what Paul who was himself a Jew, a Benjamite, a Pharisee, a Hebrew of the Hebrews. What he describes when he writes a letter to the most Gentile of all the churches, the Church of Galatia, he describes as the Israel of God. Peace be upon all, he says, and upon the Israel of God. For he knew what the term Israel meant. It meant the church in all ages, the true spiritual posterity of Jacob, who believed and by faith had power with God and with men and prevailed. And so God changed his name that night. And he became Israel. And you now know why it is that we feel confident in saying that this was the greatest moment in the history of man, considered as ordinary man. Greater than all who went before, whoever came since. Not greater than Christ, for he was the God-man who reserved himself for a later conflict, the beginning of which we call to mind this week when we lead up to the time of the year when there is specially brought before us again the wondrous story of his nativity, his birth, our God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man. From all eternity, for this great conflict, in which again he surrendered, not now to the world of Jacob, a man, but to the will of the Eternal Father, as he says in the garden, not my will, but thy will be done, and gave himself up to die, to suffer shame and pain and loss and darkness and the burden of sin and the awful curse of man's ruin and condemnation, that he might carry all through with him from cross and grave to the throne. That new creation which he came to establish, which at the Ford Jabbok he was preparing long time in advance, as he prepared mankind, and in doing so prepared himself for that great moment of his revealing. And then there was the mystery of Jacob's further reply to this incarnate Son of God who then stood before him. Jacob asked him and said, tell me, I pray thee, thy name. Some of the commentators, again, don't understand, indeed very few of them ever do, when they deal with this story, because they're always looking for the wrong thing. They're always looking to find something about Jacob which is to his discredit. And they said, what right hath Jacob to speak to the divine person, if he was a divine person, of course, who wrestled with him that night. What right had he to ask such a person his name? And so the person rebukes him by saying, why do you ask my name? As though Jacob had done something wrong. And they don't realize that Jacob had every right to ask his name, and that he got a perfect answer too. And that question was asked on your behalf and mine also, as everything Jacob did or said that night was for you and for me. Tell me, I pray thee, thy name. He wanted to penetrate the mystery, as you and I will want to penetrate the mystery in this season of the year of God becoming man, and how we too can hold omnipotence in the palms of our hands by faith. Who is this God? We need well to ask, what is thy name? For we are far, far away from understanding who and what God is and what his name really is, which is his character, which is his nature, which is the answer to the question, who really is God? Why should we not ask? The whole Bible is written to bring us to that very question. And the whole of life experience, our very creation, our life in this world is given to us for this specific reason, that we should explore this great question of all questions. And ultimately, though not in this world, get the full answer. Though we're always getting nearer to it, as Jacob did that night. What is thy name? Tell me who you are, what you are, what I am to know thee by. What is it all about? What is the mystery of it all? Tell me thy name. That's what Jacob was asking. The greatest question that ever can pass the lips of man is so to address God and say, oh God, what is thy name? Who art thou? And why? And what does it all lead to? And what is it all about? We're always getting nearer to the ultimate answer. One day, there shall be a complete unveiling. Nevertheless, not in this world can it be known. And so he replies to Jacob, wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? And that amounts to this, that what he was saying to Jacob was that my name cannot be understood by man in his present condition. And so when he came to the time of his birth, this prophecy of him began to be fulfilled. To us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. We should know his name better when he was incarnate at the Nativity, born of the Virgin Mary, as we are thinking about just now, this time of the year. The Lord help us to understand more of it. But you'll notice that in Isaiah 9 and verse 6, which we had just quoted, the first name which God gives to himself, or which gives to his son, is this. To us a child is born, to us a son is given, the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful. Now that word Wonderful means enigma, mystery, beyond finite understanding, something we cannot grasp, something we are not yet fitted to take hold of and to understand. So that later on in the book of Judges, we find Manoah and his wife, who were the parents of Samson. When the birth of Samson was announced to them that he was to be born, they asked of the angel who appeared unto them, what is your name? Taking their cue from Father Jacob of so many generations before, which proves that Jacob's question was entirely lawful, for it was repeated later on. And the angel, who is none other again than Christ, who spake with Manoah and his wife, said, wherefore is it that thou askest after my name, seeing that it is wonderful? The same word which is taken up by Isaiah in his 9th chapter. His name shall be called Wonderful. Wherefore is it that thou askest after my name, seeing that it is wonderful? It is wonderful because it is the great enigma, the great question, which stands over all creation and over your life and mine. All the greatness, dear friends, of those things that we are dealing with week by week in this fellowship, and in the fellowship of all God's true people throughout the world, as the Word of God is faithfully proclaimed. The great question to which we are all pointing, endeavoring to solve, talking about, directing all our attention, focusing all our hopes, is this question: what is his name? Who and what is he? And why? And what is it all about? He whose name is wonderful appeared amongst men, wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger. We looked upon him as he was just an ordinary child. And Mary took him up and folded him to her bosom to nourish and cherish that heavenly babe. As helpless, he clung to her with his little 10 fingers and would not let her go. In his infant strength, because he was the Son of Man as well as the Son of God. You say, I cannot understand how God can be like that. Neither can I, but I'm awfully glad about it. I'm awfully moved in my soul with a deep, settled, unutterable peace. But God is not some great and remote being about whom I ought to be terrified, whom I never will know or can know. I know now that he can be touched as Jacob touched him. He can be wrestled with as Jacob wrestled with him. He can be prevailed against. So he says to me, let me go, and I can reply, I will not. I will not let thee go unless thou bless me and tell thy name to me. Nor will we know the conflict lasts a lifetime, for in due time we will prevail against God, but only in so far as he prevails against us. For it is only when he prevailed against Jacob that Jacob became helpless in his grasp. Omnipotence, dear friends, by that we mean God. Omnipotence yields only to weakness, because omnipotence cannot be overcome or overthrown by strength, seeing all strength belongs to him. Therefore, the devil himself cannot match himself against omnipotence. And all creation that was mustered against it, angels and men, could do nothing against God. All their strength doesn't weigh one featherweight. Therefore, omnipotence, if it must be overcome, can only be overcome by weakness. And the weaker you are, the more you're likely to succeed. And so, Jacob clung to his conqueror after he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and the sinew shrank. And he halted upon his thigh the next day, that he might know that it wasn't just a vision or a dream, it was something that actually happened. And a memorial of it made in the generations of Israel ever since, that they ate not of that particular part of the body of the beast that was slain, because it had been made holy by the touch of God upon Father Jacob. And so there's memorialized that the thing actually happened. It wasn't just a dream. It wasn't just an imagination, a fiction, a story. The thing happened. Jacob bore the mark of it next day. And as he was weakened, he clung to his Savior and Lord. He said, I will not let thee go because I dare not let thee go. What will happen to me if I let thee go? I will cling to thee with all my strength and power. And to destroy that hold, you would have to destroy me, because without thee I have no hope. I will not let thee go. We think of the words of omnipotence in the prophecy of Hosea, when the Lord himself, looking upon his poor and scattered people with all their sinfulness, he says, I cannot give thee up, Ephraim. I cannot, for all that you've done against me, I cannot give you up, Ephraim. It is his hold on us which leads to our hold upon him. The initiative, therefore, is not with Jacob, but with God. God had no need to wrestle with Jacob, but by his own choice, he placed himself within the reach of man to be wrestled with and to be overcome and prevailed against by faith. His hold on us leads to our hold on him. We struggle with Jacob, first of all, to be free. And then we struggle not to be free. We struggle to retain and hold that which we have in fear lest it depart from us again. I will not let thee go unless thou bless me. So we see the analogy right throughout our human life. The tears of a child cause us to fly to the aid of the little one. We imprison the child in our own arms to shield it against all harm which might come to it. And yet who is the real prisoner? We are the prisoner of the child. The child isn't the prisoner of us. No. It imprisons us by its cries, its tears, its tiny fingers gripping hold of us so that it will not fall. So it will know its mother or its father and hold on, because mother and father are its only hope. And it clings and it prevails, and we become the prisoner of the child. And the analogy is good, because the same holds true within our souls and God. I cannot let thee go, Ephraim. I cannot give thee up. I must and I will redeem thee. I will love, and my love shall be an everlasting love. And therefore with loving kindness shall I hold thee and deliver thee, because I am imprisoned by thy prayers, thy faith, thy love. I cannot let thee go. And when we see our God in that